A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We have chatted before about the dismal rental situation in Israel, and as much as it vexes me to talk about it, I think I really have to, because if there's any issue that even if tomorrow, you know, a palace fell out of the sky thanks to some microwave prompt donor or something, I have no idea, and I lived in it and never had to worry about either renting again, or maybe I just had to worry about a mortgage, I think I couldn't detach myself from this issue, because it's been such a cause of frustration and pain that it kind of just makes me angry. And I don't say that about many things. I think the news in Israel generally makes me confused these days. I don't know what's going on. Sometimes I feel apathy, but this one really triggers an deep frustration with the status quo, and therefore a desire to understand, why is it this way? How can we change it? Let me talk about our rental situation. So currently my wife, Hannah, and I, we're two people in our mid to late 30s, depending on how generous you are with that description, with a 10-month-old baby in tow. And we're looking for a new place because our current landlord, and we had a leak late December that emanated from the neighbor's building. Our landlord didn't fix it, even though we sent him the video on the very day it started. And eventually, it was so slow in resolving anything that I asked him, can you give us a timeline? Because we, at this point, were sleeping on the couch, then in a relative's place. And I just wanted to know, are you going to fix this? When? We can't fix it. It's not our place. As a result, the landlord essentially ended our tenancy, or said, I'm going to fix it, then didn't fix it. And, oh, by the way, I'm not going to renew your lease. It was very clearly retributive, and something that in many jurisdictions, or some jurisdictions, would be illegal. But in Israel, there's no law preventing this. What are the options? You just kind of accept that there's water hitting, like, it was literally the point where it was dripping on my head. Do you either put up with that, or what you do? It's an impossible situation to be in. Our previous place, we had a nice landlord, a foreign national, who we were renting for several years, and then announced one day that he was going to give the place, his apartment, as a gift to one of his relatives. So the same situation. One day you're living somewhere, you've got a home. The next day, you know that in 2 months, you're going to have to live somewhere else. So I don't want to compare this directly to the plight of refugees, because that's way, way, way too heavy a comparison. But on a much, much more benign scale, you could say, you do end up kind of feeling like you don't really have a place. At any time, you can pay your rent. And we've always done this by the book, never late, on time. You end up even becoming kind of a custodian. If you're moving from rental to rental, you're effectively an unpaid manager for someone else's property. So not only do you have the privilege of paying their mortgage, you also often end up responsible here in Israel for disconnecting utilities, dealing with municipalities that didn't process the handover to the next tenant correctly, and then just the massive, massive amount of time that goes into packing, unpacking, disconnecting municipal tax, internet, water, all the utilities, taking them off your name, putting the same process in the next place, going through this circuitous process of viewing properties around the city, most of which are not all that wonderful, and having to pay a broker in Israel. This is something the law tried to defeat and failed. A fee which amounts to 1 month rent plus 18% VAT, just for the privilege of renting a new place. And this is the part that's almost the most unpalatable. They found some legal workaround and have effectively cornered the market, such that trying to find a place that isn't through an intermediary is essentially impossible. So it's not like you even have a choice. So I would say it's a pretty grim situation. And what I think is the most disturbing or saddening part for me is that not only is there a psychological aspect, we're people in our 30s, in our most productive years. We've worked hard. We've paid rent on time. We've done everything right, at least according to the standard formula. And yet it feels like we're dealing with a system that is just trying to break us financially and spiritually, and sometimes working. But we have the defense in the in some good Israeli wine. But I'm not endorsing turning to alcoholism as an escape, but it's almost that oppressive that you feel, you know, you feel it's despondency inducing. The lack of situation aside, or the lack of place, that sense of erosion, which is a really big thing, because how can you feel settled in a community if this is the kind of rental market you have? There's also, I think, a bigger point in which we're dealing with very hard, very challenging rental market in Israel, in which getting on the property ladder, even if you've none of this stuff, feels really hard. And then the cumulative disruption, the subtler things like a loss of income if you're self-employed during the move, all that just puts your financial position further and further away. So as somebody else, and this is the, I think, the really perverse part here, somebody who is an investor, a property investor, they own three or four places, that's whose mortgage you're paying. You're generating passive income for someone who might have several streams of it, doesn't need the shelter. And as you do so, not only are you renting, throwing money down the toilet, you're becoming progressively less able to even get your first place yourself because of all the moving costs that maybe one time isn't such a big deal. But if you take three or four of these over the course of time, it really does put a sizable dent on your bank account. And that's a really, really problematic set of fallout effects for a group of the population. Now, as my wife, Hannah, who's an architect, was looking at a place the other day, she said, you know, I think the upward increase on rent is being led by these brokers, the brokers who've cornered the market. And I always kind of felt, you know, if you're a real estate broker, wouldn't you focus on like selling, I don't know, high-end houses to people? Like, why would you want to touch the rental market? And then it occurred to me, maybe that's not the case. I mean, if you can make $2,000 or $3,000 from, you know, showing a couple of place on behalf of a landlord and do that over and over again, you can make a pretty good living. So this group clearly has an incentive to tell the landlords you can get as much rent as they think you possibly can for a space. They're acting for both parties effectively, which is a massive conflict of interest. But that's how, this is another huge gap in how the rental market works in Israel. And if we just kind of talk about the protagonists here, the invisible and the visible ones, the developer develops a property for money, sells it to often people who've no intention of ever living there, who view it as a passive income vehicle, the prototypical Israeli landlord, who maybe owns a number of them, and as their income grows, can afford to buy more expensive ones. And this ultimately then you have an intermediary layer in the market whose interest is in increasing the rate so that they can earn healthier commissions, keep the investor happy, keep the developer happy. So it's almost like there is this chain that is kind of a money go-round for everybody except the renter. The renter is the one who's suffering at all levels of the system. And what I'd like to ask you after this rather bleak presentation of the market, at least as I see it, is what we can do to change this, because it's one of those things that we either tolerate that we've created this horrible zero-sum game by which we accept that a lot of people are just going to be financially burned. Some are going to make money. That's how it is. But it's going to leave a catastrophically unequal and sick society in its wake, full of resentment and anger from people like me, who maybe you can understand why we feel so this way. Or we try to get to the heart of it. And I think we need intervention. We certainly need a reshaping of the rental market. But to do that, we need to understand what levers and incentives are not only creating this dynamic, but accelerating it such that we might be able to change it. And that's where Herman and Korn, I put my faith and my trust in you. What do you think? There are definitely, this isn't a unique case in Israel, as I mentioned, but there are some other countries that have done this, tackled this issue more thoughtfully than the failed reform we've tried to bring here. And what have they done? Over to you two.
Daniel sent us this one, and I have to say, it's the kind of prompt that lands with a thud in your chest before you even start talking about it. He and Hannah are in their mid to late 30s. They've got a 10-month-old baby, and they're being forced out of their rental because the landlord retaliated after they asked for a leak to be fixed. Water dripping on their heads while they slept on the couch, and the landlord's response was essentially, "Fine, I'm ending your lease. That's perfectly legal here." The broader question is, why is the Israeli rental market like this? Who actually benefits? And what levers exist to change it? And he wants us to look at what other countries have done that actually worked.
The thing that jumps out at me immediately is the broker fee structure he mentioned. 1 month's rent plus 18% VAT just for the privilege of renting a place. And he's right that the reform they tried here essentially failed. What happened was, the Knesset passed a law in, I believe, 2017, that was supposed to shift broker fees from the tenant to the landlord. The logic being, the landlord hires the broker, the landlord pays the broker. Simple market alignment. But the brokers found a workaround almost immediately.
What was the workaround?
They just had the landlord sign a form stating the tenant requested the broker's services. So legally, the tenant voluntarily engaged the broker, and the fee shifted right back. The law had a loophole you could drive a moving truck through. And because the rental market is so tight, vacancy rates in Tel Aviv are under 2%, Jerusalem's not much better. Tenants have zero leverage to refuse signing. You say no to the form, they rent to the next person in line.
The reform was essentially a piece of theater.
It was worse than theater. It created a pretense of protection that made tenants feel like something had been done while the actual practice didn't change at all. The brokers kept collecting from tenants, the landlords kept not paying, and everyone pretended the law mattered.
That's the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It's covering the wall, technically, but nobody's looking at it and feeling anything.
And this gets to the structural issue. In most functioning rental markets, the broker is an agent of one party. In the UK, if you go through a letting agent, the landlord pays the fees. That was actually banned for tenants in 2019. They can't charge tenants anything beyond rent and deposit. In the US, the broker typically represents either the buyer-seller or the landlord-tenant, and the fee comes from whoever hired them. In Israel, the broker has positioned themselves as somehow representing both parties while being paid entirely by the tenant. It's a conflict of interest that's baked into the business model.
Daniel made a point that I think is worth sitting with. He said, why would a real estate broker bother with rentals at all? Wouldn't they focus on sales, where the commissions are bigger? And then he realized, if you can make $2,000 or $3,000 per rental, and you can churn through those quickly, you've got a volume business with recurring revenue. Every lease renewal is potentially another fee.
It's worse than that. The broker has an incentive to drive rents up because their commission is a percentage. Higher rent means higher fee. And they have an incentive to encourage turnover because every new lease is a new commission. So you've got this intermediary layer whose financial interests are directly opposed to stable, affordable tenancy. They want churn and they want escalation.
It's like a firefighter who also sells matches.
And the landlord isn't necessarily driving this. Daniel mentioned landlords who own 3 or 4 properties. These are often people who bought apartments as investment vehicles, not as homes. They're not necessarily malicious, but they're passive. The broker comes to them and says, I can get you 200 shekels more per month, and I'll handle everything. The landlord says yes, because why wouldn't they? The tenant bears all the friction.
Let's talk about the cumulative erosion Daniel described, because I think that's the part that doesn't get enough attention in policy discussions. He's self-employed. Every move costs him not just the direct expenses, broker fee, packing, utility transfers, but lost income during the move itself. If you're moving every 2 or 3 years, which is what the data shows for Israeli renters, those costs compound. He described it as putting home ownership further and further out of reach each time.
There's a term for this in housing economics. It's called the rent trap. And Israel's version is particularly vicious because of the specific costs involved. Let me break down one move, just to put numbers on it. Broker fee, 1 month's rent plus VAT. So on a typical Tel Aviv apartment renting for, say, 6,000 shekels, that's about 7,000 shekels just for the broker. then you've got the actual moving costs, the overlap period where you're paying rent on two places because leases don't align perfectly, the utility connection fees, the municipal tax registration. You're looking at probably 15 to 20,000 shekels per move, easily. Do that 3 times in a decade, and you spent 60,000 shekels that could have been a down payment.
That's before you get to the psychological cost. Daniel said something that I think is the real wound here. He said he feels like he doesn't really have a place. He was careful not to compare it to the refugee experience. And I think that's right. But the core feeling is real. You pay your rent on time. You follow every rule. And you still have no security. Your home can be taken away because a landlord decides to give the apartment to a relative, or because you ask for a leak to be fixed.
That lack of security is actually the thing that most developed rental markets have tried to solve. Because it's not just a feeling, it has measurable effects on health outcomes, on child development, on community cohesion. When people move involuntarily every few years, they don't put down roots. They don't join the community council. They don't get to know their neighbors. Their kids switch schools. It atomizes communities.
Let's get to the heart of the question. What levers exist? Daniel asked us to look at what other countries have done, and he specifically said he doesn't want to just tolerate this as a zero-sum game where some people get rich and everyone else gets financially burned. What's actually worked elsewhere?
I think we need to look at 3 categories. One is rent stabilization and tenant protections, the legal framework around eviction and lease renewal. 2 is the intermediary problem, brokers and fees. And 3 is the supply side. Who builds, who buys, and what incentives shape that? Different countries have attacked different pieces of this.
Start with the tenant protections piece. You mentioned the UK banned tenant fees.
Germany is probably the most cited example. They have what's called a rent break, the Mietpreisbremse, which limits rent increases in tight housing markets to 10% above the local comparable rent, and caps increases at 15% over 3 years for existing tenancies. But the more important thing is their lease structure. Open-ended leases are the default. You don't sign a 1-year lease in Germany. You sign a lease that continues indefinitely, and the landlord can only evict you for specific, legally defined reasons. I want to give the apartment to my nephew is not one of them, unless the landlord themselves lives in the building.
Daniel's situation. The landlord deciding not to renew because he was annoyed about being asked to fix a leak. That simply couldn't happen in Germany.
It couldn't happen in Germany, it couldn't happen in the Netherlands, it couldn't happen in Sweden, it couldn't happen in France. Most European countries have some form of just cause eviction protection. You can only be evicted for non-payment, for the landlord or their immediate family needing to move in, or for major renovation that makes the unit uninhabitable. And even then, there are notice periods, often 3 to 6 months, sometimes longer if you've lived there a long time. In Israel, the standard lease is 1 year, and the landlord can simply choose not to renew for any reason or no reason.
The argument against just cause eviction protections is always that they'll discourage landlords from renting out properties. If you can't easily remove a tenant, you won't invest in rental housing. Does the evidence bear that out?
Germany has one of the highest rental rates in Europe. Over 50% of the population rents, and it works. The key is that the rules are stable and predictable. Landlords know what they're getting into, and they price accordingly. The rental market doesn't collapse because landlords can't evict at will. It just means the business model shifts from speculative churn to long-term steady income, which, by the way, is what most small landlords actually want. They want a reliable tenant who pays on time and stays for years. The churn model benefits brokers, not landlords.
That's the thing Daniel keeps coming back to. He's been a model tenant. Paid on time, never late, took care of the place, and the system still chewed him up. It's not rewarding good behavior.
Because the incentives are misaligned at every level. Let me give you another example. In Switzerland, rental deposits are held in escrow accounts that earn interest for the tenant. In Israel, landlords hold the deposit, and getting it back is notoriously difficult. There's no standardized process, no requirement for the money to be held separately, and disputes over damages are common. Daniel mentioned a previous episode about scuff marks. This is a real issue. Landlords use the deposit as leverage.
What about the broker problem specifically? Is there a country that solved that cleanly?
The cleanest solution is probably what the UK did in 2019 with the Tenant Fees Act. It banned all letting agent fees charged to tenants. Not just broker fees, but also fees for reference checks, credit checks, inventory checks, everything. The only things a landlord or agent can charge a tenant are rent, a refundable deposit capped at 5 weeks' rent, and a few specific things like replacing lost keys. If an agent charges a prohibited fee, they can be fined up to £5,000 for a first offense, and it becomes a criminal offense for repeat violations.
Enforcement actually happens?
Local trading standards offices handle it, and there's been a fair amount of enforcement. The sky didn't fall. Rents didn't spike to compensate. There was some adjustment, but the market absorbed it. Agents just started charging landlords for their services, which is who they should have been charging all along, since landlords are the ones hiring them.
That's the part that's so perverse about the Israeli setup. The broker is hired by the landlord to find a tenant, but the tenant pays. It's like going to a restaurant where the chef picks your meal and then hands you the bill for his consulting fee.
The VAT part is particularly galling. Daniel mentioned 18% VAT on the broker fee. That's not a small add-on. On a 7,000 shekel broker fee, you're paying over 1,000 shekels just in tax for a service you didn't hire. The UK approach says, look, if the landlord is running a business, the landlord pays the business expenses, including the agent.
Let me ask you about the supply side, because Daniel touched on this too. He described this chain. Developer builds, sells to an investor who never intends to live there. Investor rents it out through a broker whose incentive is to drive up rents. The renter is the only one in this chain who actually needs shelter. Everyone else is extracting value.
This is where it gets into deeper policy territory. Israel has a housing supply problem, but it's not just about the number of units. It's about who owns them and what incentives shape their behavior. A huge portion of Israeli rental housing is owned by small-scale investors, people who bought a second or third apartment as a retirement vehicle. There's very little institutional rental housing, the kind you see in the US or Germany where a company owns a whole building and manages it professionally.
Why is that?
Partly tax policy. Israel's tax code has historically favored buying apartments over other forms of investment. There's no capital gains tax on the sale of a primary residence, and until relatively recently, the tax on investment properties was quite favorable. So if you had savings, the default move was to buy an apartment and rent it out. It became the Israeli middle-class pension plan. But that creates a market dominated by amateur landlords who are often undercapitalized. They can't afford to fix a leak promptly because they're stretched thin on mortgage payments. And they're emotionally attached in weird ways. It's not just a business asset, it's their security, so they can be erratic.
Daniel's landlord who retaliated because he was asked to fix a leak. That's exactly the amateur landlord pathology. A professional property manager would just fix the leak because it's cheaper than losing a paying tenant and dealing with a vacancy.
And this connects to something Daniel's wife Hannah said. She's an architect, and she observed that brokers are driving rent increases. I think she's onto something, but I'd add a layer. The brokers are the visible mechanism, but the underlying driver is that small landlords don't know how to price their units. They're not professional property managers doing market analysis. They ask the broker, what can I get? And the broker, whose commission depends on the answer, says more. The broker becomes the de facto pricing mechanism for the entire market, and their incentive is always upward.
If we're thinking about levers for change, we've got at least four buckets. One, tenant protections. Just 'cause eviction, longer notice periods, open-ended leases. Two, broker reform. Real reform this time, with enforcement. Shifting fees to landlords. 3. Deposit reform. Escrow accounts. Standardized dispute resolution. And 4. Supply-side changes to encourage institutional rental housing rather than amateur buy-to-let.
I'd add a fifth, which is tax policy. Right now, the tax code effectively subsidizes the small investor model. If you wanted to shift toward institutional rental, companies that build and manage rental buildings professionally, you'd need to change the incentives. Some countries offer tax breaks to developers who build purpose, built rental housing and commit to long-term operation. Others tax vacant units to discourage speculation. Vancouver has a vacancy tax, for example, and it's been quite effective at pushing units back onto the market.
Let's talk about the politics of this, because reforms keep failing. The broker fee reform failed because of a loophole. Why wasn't the loophole closed?
Because the brokers are an organized interest group and tenants are not. Brokers have a trade association. They have lobbyists. They show up at Knesset committee hearings. Tenants are diffuse, disorganized, and by definition transient. By the time a renter is angry enough to organize, their lease is up and they're moving. It's a classic collective action problem.
The people with the most incentive to change the system are the ones least able to organize to do so.
And the people who benefit from the current system. Brokers, investors who've seen property values rise, developers who sell to investors, they're organized and motivated. This is why reform keeps failing. It's not that nobody knows what to do, it's that the political economy is stacked.
Is there a counterexample, a place where tenants did organize successfully?
Berlin had a major tenant movement that led to a 5-year rent freeze in 2020, though it was eventually struck down by Germany's constitutional court. But the broader tenant protections in Germany that we mentioned earlier, those came out of sustained organizing over decades. Tenant unions in Germany are membership organizations with real resources. They provide legal advice, they negotiate with landlords collectively, they lobby. In Switzerland, the Tenants Association has something like 200,000 members and runs a legal insurance scheme. You pay a small annual fee and they cover your legal costs in disputes with your landlord.
Israel doesn't have anything like that.
Not at scale. There are some tenant advocacy groups, but nothing with the membership base or institutional heft of the European tenant unions. And the rental population in Israel is growing. It's now over 30% of households, and higher in cities like Tel Aviv, where it's over 45%. That's a lot of potential political power, but it's not organized.
Daniel mentioned something that I think gets at the emotional core here. He said this issue makes him angry in a way that few things do. The news confuses him, politics confuses him, but this is a clear injustice that he experiences directly. And I think that clarity is actually valuable. When you can see exactly how a system is designed to extract from you, the anger isn't just frustration, it's information.
That's well put. And he's right to be angry. The rental market in Israel isn't just inconvenient, it's structurally extractive in ways that are preventable. Other countries have prevented them. This isn't an unsolvable problem.
Let's get concrete. If someone who cares about this issue wanted to push for change, what's the highest impact thing they could do?
I think there are two high-impact reforms that are politically achievable relative to their effect. The first is broker fee reform with actual teeth. Not the 2017 version with its laughable loophole, but a UK-style ban on tenant-paid broker fees with real penalties. Make it a fine of 20,000 shekels per violation. Make the landlord jointly liable if they sign off on the workaround and fund enforcement. That alone would remove a massive upfront cost from every move and reduce broker incentive to drive rent increases. Just cause eviction. Require landlords to have a specific, legally defined reason not to renew a lease and require minimum notice periods that scale with tenancy length. 3 months if you've lived there 1 to 3 years, 6 months if you've been there longer. This is standard in most of Europe. It wouldn't prevent landlords from eventually reclaiming their property, but it would prevent retaliatory evictions and give tenants enough time to actually find a new place without panic.
Those both seem like things that could be passed if there were political will. They're not radical. They're not rent control. They're just basic protections that exist in functioning rental markets.
And I think that's an important framing. This isn't about punishing landlords or creating some socialist housing utopia. It's about aligning incentives so that the rental market functions for the people it's supposed to serve, the people who need a place to live. Right now, the Israeli rental market is optimized for everyone except the tenant. The developer, the investor, the broker, they all get paid. The tenant gets uncertainty, escalating costs, and the constant low-grade anxiety of knowing their home isn't really theirs.
Daniel described it as feeling like an unpaid custodian for someone else's property. You're paying their mortgage, you're managing their utilities, you're dealing with the municipality on their behalf, and then they can kick you out because you asked them to fix a leak. It's a deeply undignified position.
It's worth noting that this isn't just a young person problem. Daniel and Hannah are in their mid to late 30s with a child. They're professionals. They've done everything right by the standard playbook, and they're still in this situation. That's the sign of a broken market, when following the rules doesn't protect you.
There's something else in Daniel's prompt that I want to pull out. He talked about the cumulative effect, not just the direct costs, but the way each move sets you back financially from ever buying your own place, the rent trap you mentioned. And he connected it to a broader point about inequality. The people collecting passive income from multiple properties are, by definition, building wealth. The people paying rent are, by definition, not building wealth through housing. And every time the renter moves, the gap widens.
This is actually one of the most important long-term trends in housing economics. Home ownership has been the primary vehicle for middle-class wealth accumulation in most developed countries. If a growing portion of the population is locked out of ownership, and the rental system actively extracts from them in ways that make ownership harder to achieve, you're creating a structural wealth divide that compounds over generations.
It's not just economic. Daniel talked about the psychological erosion, the sense of not having a place, of being unmoored from community. That's a real cost. People who move involuntarily every few years don't join the parent-teacher association, don't run for the community council, don't invest in local relationships the same way. They're just trying to get through the next move.
There's research on this. Residential instability is associated with worse outcomes for children, higher stress levels, lower civic participation. It's not just an inconvenience, it's a public health and social cohesion issue. And in Israel, where community and rootedness are culturally central, the dissonance is particularly sharp.
We've got the diagnosis. We've got some policy levers that have worked elsewhere. Let me ask you the uncomfortable question. Given the political economy you described, organized brokers, passive landlords who benefit from the current setup, disorganized tenants, what actually changes the calculus? What creates the political will?
I think it takes a catalytic event, or a generational shift. The catalytic event could be a housing affordability crisis that becomes impossible to ignore. We're already seeing protests about cost of living in Israel, and housing is the biggest line item for most households. If the rental crisis becomes a central political issue, politicians will respond. The generational shift is that more and more Israelis are renting into their 30s and 40s. When the median voter was a homeowner, rental policy was a niche concern. As renters become a larger share of the electorate, their interests gain political weight.
There's a grim optimism there. Things get bad enough that they have to change, or the people who need change become too numerous to ignore.
That's essentially the story of tenant protections in every country that has them. They weren't gifted by benevolent governments. They were won through organizing and political pressure, usually after a crisis made the status quo untenable. The UK's tenant fee ban came after years of campaigning by groups like Shelter and Generation Rent. Germany's protections were built up over decades of tenant organizing. None of this happened overnight.
Daniel, if you're listening, and I know you are, I think the most useful thing we can say is that your anger is well placed, but it's not unique, and that's actually a good thing. You're not alone in this. There are a lot of people in exactly your position, and if that energy can be channeled into collective action, tenant unions, political advocacy, even just talking about this publicly in ways that make it harder to ignore, that's how change starts.
In the meantime, on a practical level, the one thing individual renters can do is understand their rights, limited as they are, and push back where possible. The leak, the landlord's response, the timeline. Israel's tenant protections are weak, but they're not zero, and having a paper trail matters if things escalate. But the real solution is systemic. The market is broken by design, and fixing it requires changing the design.
I keep coming back to that broker fee. It's such a perfect symbol of everything wrong with this market. You're paying a month's rent plus VAT to someone you didn't hire for a service that benefits the landlord in a transaction you can't avoid because the brokers have cornered the market. It's a tax on being a renter, collected by private actors who have every incentive to make your life harder.
It's a tax that compounds. Every move, another month's rent gone. If the average Israeli renter moves every 2 to 3 years, that's something like 15 to 20% of their annual rent going to broker fees over the course of a decade. Imagine if you could put that money toward a down payment instead.
That's the rent trap in a single statistic. The system is designed to keep you renting, and every time you move, it takes another bite out of your ability to escape.
Which brings us back to the broader point. This isn't just about making renting more pleasant. It's about whether a society wants a housing market that creates a permanent renter class with no path to stability or ownership. Israel is heading in that direction, And it's a choice. Other countries have made different choices.
The choices aren't mysterious. They're not untested. They exist, they work, and they're politically achievable if the will is there. That's the frustrating part. We know what to do. It's just a question of whether enough people demand it.
One last thing I want to mention, because Daniel brought up the comparison to other countries. He said this isn't a uniquely Israeli problem, and he's right. Housing affordability crises are global. But Israel's rental market has some specific features that make it particularly brutal. The one-year lease norm, the broker fee structure, the lack of just cause eviction, the amateur landlord dominance. None of these are inevitable. They're policy choices, and they can be unmade.
The fact that the 2017 reform failed so completely, that's actually useful information. It tells you what doesn't work. A law without enforcement is a suggestion. A loophole will be found and exploited. The next reform has to be designed with that in mind. No workarounds, real penalties, and someone whose job it is to enforce them.
The UK model of local trading standards offices handling enforcement is interesting because it creates a clear point of accountability. If a tenant gets charged an illegal fee, they know where to report it, and the office has the power to levy fines. Israel would need something similar, a dedicated enforcement body, not just a law on the books.
I think we've covered the ground Daniel asked us to cover. The diagnosis is grim, the solutions exist, and the path to getting there runs through political organizing and sustained pressure. Not a satisfying answer if you're sleeping on a couch with water dripping on your head, but it's the honest one.
The honest answer is sometimes more useful than a comforting one. The system is extractive by design. Changing it requires confronting the people who benefit from the extraction. That's not easy, but it's not impossible either. Other countries have done it.
On that note, I think we've earned our daily dose of complete irrelevance.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1962, a film crew in Kyrgyzstan accidentally discovered the oldest known surviving feature film script from Central Asia. It was a silent drama titled Lost Caravan, written in 1917, and had been used as insulation in the wall of a yurt for over 40 years.
Used as insulation? In a yurt?
I mean, it worked, apparently. The script survived.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. If this episode resonated, leave us a review. It genuinely helps other people find the show. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.